So if you think about converting one of those massive million square foot warehouses, it's a lot like trying to steer a cruise ship.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Right, because it's just incredibly capital intensive. The turning radius is absolutely massive. And once you set that trajectory, you're just locked in.
You can't just pivot.
Exactly. If an iceberg appears on the horizon, or if the market suddenly shifts, you cannot just spin the wheel. You are hitting the ice.
You're hitting it hard.
And right now, looking at the data, a staggering number of institutional investors are hitting the ice very, very hard.
Yeah, the headline data coming out of secondary markets right now is it's certainly painting a grim picture for those massive industrial projects. I mean, we're seeing this real surge in servicing reports that are just flagging distress across these mega developments.
Which is exactly why we're dedicating today's deep dive to unpacking the mechanics of this shift. Because that surface data, specifically the rising delinquencies we're seeing in places like Philadelphia, it's actually masking the real story for investors.
It is. It's totally obscuring where the actual yield is.
Right. So today we are pulling directly from the latest edition of Pre's Perspective. It's this highly influential newsletter authored by Priyanshu Adithakar.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
It's essential reading. Pri is a top-tier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor, and his thesis here, it completely reframes the current panic. We really want to understand why the real market advantage, like the actual alpha, is hiding in properties that are just a fraction of that cruise ship size.
Yeah, his analysis is incredibly sharp on this. Pri points out that treating industrial as this monolithic asset class is just a fundamental underwriting error right now.
You can't just lump it all together.
Exactly. The large institutional funds, they're failing in these saturated urban cores with those massive mega developments, but the alpha hasn't vanished. I mean, it's just migrated.
It's moved down the street, basically.
Right, it's shifted into what Pri calls the edge neighborhoods.
So if you're an investor and you're looking at a landscape where funds with virtually endless resources are taking a bath, it's crucial to figure out how nimble, localized capital is actively finding gold in the periphery.
You have to follow the smart money.
Right. So we need to look really closely at what Pri identifies as the sweet spot asset class. How is the nimble investor actually surviving this?
Well, it starts with understanding that the delinquency data creating all those scary headlines, it's largely an illusion of scale.
Interesting. How so?
When you dig into those distressed Philadelphia portfolios, you realize it's actually a warning shot about leverage and timing. It's not a lack of end user demand.
Ah, so people still want the space.
Oh, consumer and tenant demand for industrial conversions remains incredibly robust.
Yeah.
The big players aren't failing because their end product is unwanted.
Right, they're failing because the sheer mechanics of those giant projects are fundamentally flawed in a volatile rate environment.
Exactly. They are crushing themselves under the weight of capital requirements and, these multi-year entitlement phases.
Oh, the red tape.
Yeah, when you're developing a million square feet, you are locked into years of environmental impact studies, traffic mitigation negotiations, community board fights.
All before a single hammer swings.
Right. You're carrying massive debt loads while the market just shifts entirely beneath your feet.
Which brings us to Pri's sweet spot, because he argues that the smarter play, the real alpha, is targeting small industrial clusters. We're talking specifically about properties in the 3 to 40 unit range.
Yeah, the smaller footprint.
Exactly. Mid-century flex spaces, old tool and die shops, small-scale distribution hubs.
And the beauty of these smaller footprints is that they entirely bypass that bureaucratic gridlock we just talked about.
Because they're already there.
Right. The entitlement process for a 30,000 square foot footprint is just a fraction of the time and cost of a mega development.
Okay, but let me challenge that premise for a second. If you're underwriting a deal right now and you're targeting a 3 to 40 unit building purely to avoid a prolonged city council fight, I mean, that feels like a defensive strategy.
Like a loophole.
Yeah, it's a zoning loophole. Does price data suggest there is actually something inherently superior about the physical final product? Or is this just entirely about speed to market?
That is the critical distinction. And honestly, it highlights why Pri's boots on the ground approach is so valuable for operators. It is absolutely about the physical product, too.
Okay.
These specific types of smaller buildings, especially that mid-century stock, they were completely over-engineered.
They were built like tanks back then.
Exactly. They possess an inherent structural integrity that modern developers spend an absolute fortune trying to replicate today.
So we're talking about the load-bearing capacities and the clear heights.
Heavy timber beams, masonry walls, expansive column spacing, and incredibly high floor load capacities.
Right.
So not only does the smaller scale dramatically accelerate your speed to market, but you're also inheriting this structural canvas that already possesses a premium aesthetic.
You don't have to manufacture the character.
No, it's permanently baked into the architecture.
Okay, but finding the right physical shell, that's really only half the battle. Because if you know you need that 3 to 40 unit structural canvas, the geographic placement of that asset completely dictates your upside.
Location is everything.
Always. And Prey's analysis of where to deploy capital right now is arguably the most contrarian part of his entire perspective.
Yeah, he makes it very clear you do not deploy capital where the market has already arrived.
If a neighborhood is already featured in lifestyle magazines for its trendy loft conversions, it's too late. The alpha has been squeezed out.
You're just paying retail pricing for the dirt at that point, which immediately compresses your yields from day one.
Right. So Pry's perspective hinges entirely on identifying what he calls the edge neighborhood. It's this specific transitional zone where existing grit meets incoming gentrification.
And geographically, Pry defines this as a radius exactly 1 to 2 miles outside of those established high-rent districts.
But wait, throwing a dart at a map 2 miles outside the urban core, that carries massive pioneer risk.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, if you're buying into a neighborhood with cracked sidewalks and old streetlights and that neighborhood fails to turn, you are stuck holding an overdesigned warehouse in a totally dead zip code.
You take a huge loss.
Exactly. So how does Pre account for the risk of being too early?
Well, he accounts for it by targeting what he calls microclusters. So you aren't just buying isolated real estate in the middle of nowhere. You have to look for industrial buildings situated immediately adjacent to existing third places.
The third places, so the social environments outside of home and work.
Right. You isolate a gritty, abandoned workshop, but it happens to sit maybe a 2-minute walk from a thriving artisan roastery or a craft brewery or, you know, a boutique fitness studio.
Okay, I see.
The presence of those third places acts as your risk mitigator. It proves there's already a daytime population there with disposable income, who are actively willing to travel into the grit.
Because they want that specific coffee or that workout class.
Exactly. And what Prieriv calls the infrastructure lag means the city hasn't beautified those streets yet, which is what keeps your entry basis low.
That infrastructure lag is exactly where the margin lives. You acquire the asset at a discount because the block still looks rough. But by repositioning that building into a boutique industrial space, your project actually becomes the catalyst.
You push it over the edge.
Right. You push the microcluster over the tipping point. You aren't passively waiting for the city's capital improvement plan to finally catch up to your block.
No. Your capital injection is what triggers the neighborhood's discovery phase.
Which is just a brilliantly aggressive, active approach to placemaking. But triggering a neighborhood's discovery phase is completely useless if you build a product nobody actually wants to occupy.
That's the trap.
You have to deeply understand the demographic moving into these gritty areas and how to underwrite their very specific demands.
And according to Priyanshu Adathakar's industry analysis, the tenant profile driving this demand is undergoing a massive structural shift. We're looking at the creative class now.
So high-end designers, freelance professionals, boutique tech firms.
Specialized agencies, yeah. Demographics that are just fundamentally untethered from traditional corporate headquarters.
They can work from a laptop anywhere.
They can operate from anywhere. And because they have that flexibility, they are actively trading central business district proximity for architectural character and neighborhood soul.
They don't want the sterile environment.
No, they're completely rejecting those cookie-cutter glass boxes in the financial district because those spaces offer zero cultural identity.
Right. To get this demographic to sign a lease, the physical space has to offer an aesthetic experience that they just cannot replicate in a home office or a standard corporate tower.
And to capture that demographic and actually command a premium, Pry outlines a very sharp operational distinction here. He says you cannot simply renovate these spaces. You must reposition them.
Okay, break that down because that's an important distinction for analysts to catch.
Renovation is defensive. It's fixing the roof, upgrading the HVAC. Repositioning, on the other hand, is an offensive strategy. It's elevating the asset into a completely different tier.
High design lofts that lean really heavily into that industrial aesthetic.
We're talking steel frame window systems, aggressively polished concrete floors, wide open concept layouts. That deliberate design execution commands a rental premium that easily justifies the capital expenditure of the conversion.
But operators frequently fall into a trap here, and Pri lays out this massive warning in his newsletter about maintaining adaptive reuse authenticity.
You have to keep the soul of the building.
Right. He emphasizes that if you acquire a rugged mid-century workshop and your general contractor tries to value engineer the project by throwing up standard drywall and cheap drop ceilings, you are actively destroying your own yield.
Sanitizing the space directly kills your rental premium.
It really does. Pri points out that value engineering the finishes erodes the exact identity the creative class is paying top dollar for. It's like putting vinyl siding on a historic log cabin.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. You might think you're modernizing the asset, but you're actively destroying the specific authenticity your demographic actually values.
Exactly. I mean, if a specialized tech firm wanted a sterile, drywall-heavy environment, they would just lease Class A office space downtown.
They wouldn't be in the Edge neighborhood.
They're seeking out your property specifically for the exposed brick, the historical timber, the sheer industrial scale. If you cover that up to save, 10% on your construction budget, you have fundamentally misunderstood your own product market fit.
And that aesthetic authenticity, it ties directly into the timeline for the lease-up strategy, too. Because if you wait until the certificate of occupancy is issued to start finding these niche tenants, you're already way behind.
It's too late by then. Pri notes you need to start aggressively marketing the property a full 6 months before completion.
You deploy the high-end, lifestyle-focused renderings that really sell the vision.
Because commercial leases take months to negotiate. High-quality commercial tenants are usually out looking for space 9 to 12 months before their current leases even expire.
You're not just selling a floor plan. You're selling the cultural cachet of being anchored next to the best third places in a Rising Edge neighborhood.
Right. So let's run the scenario.
Okay.
You secure the 30-unit sweet spot building. You mitigate the pioneer risk by buying into a microcluster in an Edge neighborhood. You preserve the authentic soul of the building, avoiding the vinyl siding on the log cabin trap.
Right.
The high-end renderings are live. Fundamentally, you've built the perfect product.
On paper, the asset is absolutely flawless.
Right.
But this brings us to the most critical, highly technical aspect of Pri's perspective. The trap that is actually driving those severe delinquency rates we discussed at the top of the show, it isn't a failure of real estate strategy.
No, it's not the building.
It is a failure of debt structure.
This is where the mechanics get incredibly unforgiving. A perfectly designed building can still bankrupt an investor if the capital stack is misaligned.
So industrial conversions in these transitioning edge neighborhoods, they suffer from intense lease-up friction. Let's unpack the mechanics of that friction. Why does it take so long to stabilize these specific assets?
Well, when you introduce a brand new product type like these premium creative lofts to a microcluster that is still rough around the edges, there is no deep pool of comps.
Right. There's no data.
You are literally establishing the top of the market in real time. It takes significant time for early adopter commercial tenants to break their existing leases, finalize custom buildouts, and actually move in.
And you have to factor in construction delays.
Exactly. The supply chain delays for the premium architectural finishes required for these repositionings, they often push construction timelines outward. Pri's data clearly shows this stabilization period typically drags out to 12 to 18 months.
Wow. So if you're an investor underwriting a project that realistically requires 15 months of runway to physically stabilize and reach a healthy DSCR.
The debt service coverage ratio, right?
Right. But you finance the construction with a standard 12-month bridge loan.
You have literally engineered your own default.
That is brutal.
Your loan matures, demanding full repayment or a forced refinance 3 full months before your asset is generating the net operating income required to carry permanent debt.
And as Pri bluntly puts it in his newsletter, which I just love, he says, if you overleverage a 15-month project with a 12-month bridge loan, you aren't an investor, you're a gambler.
That cuts right to the bone.
Doesn't it? The building itself didn't fail. The Edge neighborhood thesis didn't fail. The debt maturity wall simply crashed into the lease-up curve.
It's entirely a failure of the debt structure aligning with the reality of the asset class.
So how do you fix it?
Well, to survive the conversion economy, Pri outlines 3 non-negotiable financing mechanisms that absolutely must be baked into your capital stack. First, heavy interest reserves.
You need interest reserves modeled to cover at least 18 months post-CO.
Yes. Even after the building is legally habitable, you need 18 months of capitalized breathing room built into the loan structure. That's what prevents a technical default while you aggressively pursue that lease-up strategy.
Okay, what's the second mechanism?
The second is flexible extensions. You cannot tie your debt maturity to arbitrary calendar dates. You just can't. You must negotiate 12-month extension options with your lender that are explicitly tied to performance milestones.
So if you secure a specific percentage of pre-leases or you hit a targeted NOI, the extension triggers automatically.
Exactly, which shields you from broader macro market volatility on a fixed date.
That makes total sense. But it's the third mechanism that I think really requires a deep dive because it fundamentally changes who you can even do business with.
Right, the lender profile.
PRE emphasizes the need for bridge to permanent debt from lenders who deeply understand the creative loft niche. Because if you take a visionary repositioning project to a traditional commercial lender, their underwriting matrix is just going to destroy your loan-to-value ratio.
A traditional regional bank underwrites risk by looking backward.
Always.
They look at a 60-year-old tool and die shop in a transitioning zip code, and they value it based strictly on the lagging comps of standard unrenovated industrial space in that exact radius.
Right. Their underwriting software does not have a toggle for polished concrete or historic architectural provenance.
They don't know how to model the rental premium generated by the building's soul, so they drastically underappraise the stabilized value of the project.
Which just starves your project of the initial leverage you need to execute those high-end finishes.
Exactly. So PRE's mandate here is that you must seek out specialized debt funds or highly localized lenders who specialize in adaptive reuse.
The niche players.
Yeah, these niche lenders underwrite the sponsor's track record and the micro-location. They understand that a specialized design firm will gladly pay a 20% premium over market for that exposed brick.
If your capital partner doesn't understand the nuance of the product, they are a liability, not a partner.
100%.
So synthesizing all of these moving parts, I mean, we've got the meticulous structural evaluation of that 30-unit sweet spot, the precise geographic targeting of the microclusters, the architectural repositioning, and obviously the specialized debt structuring.
It's a lot to manage.
It is, but it brings us to the ultimate thesis of Priyanshu Adithakar's perspective on the market.
Which is that in this specific iteration of the conversion economy, an operator's most valuable asset is not the brick and mortar, it is patience.
Patience engineered through proper capitalization. You have to mathematically align your debt with the harsh reality of that 12 to 18 month lease-up curve.
If you respect the timeline and focus intensely on the boutique 3 to 40 unit scale, you are positioning yourself directly in the path of the alpha that massive, slow-moving institutional funds are entirely missing.
And look, whether you are managing institutional capital, analyzing commercial adjacencies for a hotel portfolio, or just, you know, tracking how urban microeconomies evolve, you really have to recognize the fundamental difference between a real estate failure and a debt structure failure.
The delinquency headlines are largely an illusion driven by poor capitalization, not poor assets.
Priyanshu Adithakar has clearly established himself as the definitive authority on navigating these complex conversions. I mean, by cutting through the macro panic, he maps out exactly how the mechanics of these deals are functioning on the street level.
It's an incredibly rigorous framework for finding yield in a highly fractured market.
It really is. But as you evaluate your own local edge neighborhoods, there is a fascinating long-term risk profile for you to consider. The massive million-square-foot mega warehouses, they were considered the ultimate safe bet until the market fundamentals shifted overnight.
Right.
And right now, PRE has accurately identified that the current alpha relies heavily on the creative class prioritizing a very specific aesthetic, architectural authenticity, polished concrete, industrial grit.
It's the defining cultural aesthetic of the current workforce.
But demographic tastes are never static. So if you're modeling a 10-year hold on one of these boutique properties, you have to ask yourself, what happens when Gen Z and Generation Alpha fully dictate the commercial market?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
What happens when they decide that exposed brick and steel-framed windows are simply, you know, the boring offices their parents liked? Will today's highly sought-after authentic industrial become tomorrow's outdated value-engineered trend?
That's the million-dollar question.
It is. Because even if you are piloting a nimble speedboat instead of a massive cruise ship, you still have to constantly monitor the horizon to see where the cultural tide is going to pull you next.